Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night. And it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artists First World Radio Network. Tonight we're broadcasting live from our studios in the center of Canada, Thunder Bay in Ontario, and Rock Hill, South Carolina, that Confederate state. At this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron is an award-winning author based in South Carolina. He's the author of 29 books, including Sergeant Smack, The Lives and Times of Ike Atkinson, Kingpin, and His Band of Brothers, and the just-published Straight from the Hood, Amazing but True Gangster Tales. He's also the producer of two award-winning documentaries. Get out there and buy these books, and be sure to check out his documentary DVDs. You won't be disappointed, that's for sure. Ron is also a consultant to History Channel's Gangland documentary series and publisher of Strategic Media Books. He's all over the place, this guy. You can go to www.strategicmediabooks.com. Be sure to visit his website at Ron Chepsik. That's www.ronchepsik.com. I'll spell you his last name. It's Chepsiuk. You can also join him on Facebook and Twitter. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio on my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, which happens to be my hometown as well, and has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in international shipping business, where he's a contributing writer to several trade publications. This year, he'll be publishing a book about movers and mavericks, an anthology about influential people from the Thunder Bay area, and early next year, a book about the famous Ganalva shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossport on Lake Superior. Willie?
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie. Thanks for the promo. That book is coming out in about 10 days. We're really excited about it, and we're going to make a big splash, and hopefully a lot of people will get out there and buy the book. Now, as you know, we have a great guest tonight. It's Benjamin Runkle, author of best-selling book titled Wanted, Dead or Alive, Manhunt for Geronimo to Bin Laden. In a dramatic late-night appearance in early May of 2011, U.S. President Barack Obama declared that justice had been done with the startling announcement that Osama bin Laden was dead. After more than a decade of military operations across Central Asia and Middle East, the infamous Al-Qaeda leader who orchestrated the 9/11 terrorist attacks on New York City was killed in a daring Navy SEALs operation in Pakistan. Benjamin Runkle will discuss these events and much more. It's going to be a great show. Stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure. Well, Ronnie, you know what? Before we get into our mailbag, this is our 41st show, and you know we're running out of space, as they say, on our notch on our Smith and Wesson. There's no turning back the clock now, and you know what? It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we're right on track, buddy.
Right, and it's so much fun. You know, one week we talk about the mafia in Cleveland, the next week about a conspiracy theory involving President Kennedy's assassination, and this week we're talking about manhunts. So it's a real history lesson tonight, as it always is with our show.
Absolutely. We're all over the place on this, and I'm glad we've got a great audience tonight. And I'd like to thank all our production people at Artists First World Radio Network this evening, in particular Scott, Corey, and Tony, for making the show possible. And you know what? Like I said, internet radio is the place to be. Now, here's this week's mailbag. Hey, Ronnie, this one's from Merrick Thane of South Dakota, who writes, "Your show with James Douglas was one of your best, dude." Hey, he says, "Your description of the plot to kill John Kennedy only reinforced what I believed really happened in Dallas 48 years ago. I just finished reading his book, JFK and the Unspeakable, and it's right on the mark. I recommend it highly." Any comments, Ronnie?
Yeah, I love being called dude. You know, we've got such an august show, and to be referred to as dude. But we appreciate that comment. And yeah, you know, it was very interesting. You hear a lot of conspiracy theories, but James Douglas' theory was well researched, and you know, he was a really compelling guest. So it was really fascinating to have him on the show. And of course, he never said anything that he said that he couldn't back up with documentation.
Absolutely fascinating interview, fascinating book. I recommend it to all our listeners out there. Now, Cindy Kraskowski of Chicago, Illinois writes, how can 48 years go by and there's still no official definitive statement from our government saying the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy was a planned event hatched in the highest levels of the United States government? It's reprehensible that subsequent governments have hid the truth for so long. Hey, Ronnie, Cindy's got something to say here. Anything to add to that?
Well, I don't know about a planned event because, you know, the government accepts the you know, Warren Commission, there's the official version, which says that Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole killer. But, you know, people just have a hard time believing it. I mean, as the years go by, it seems that it doesn't really diminish this belief in a conspiracy. And I don't know how good it is for our democracy that this continues to persist. But I guess we'll have to wait for maybe the records, when the record Warren Commission records are released in a couple decades, to see if there's going to be any kind of information that can help settle this.
You bet. Yeah, there's a lot of dubious people out there, and the sooner we find out the truth, the better the country will be. Now, this one's from David Gibb, author of Camouflage Killer. He writes, just wanted to say that I really enjoyed being with you and your listeners on Crime Beat on November the 10th. While it's a very disturbing and complex case, you guys approached the graphic details with respect and class, and without shying away from some very difficult and probing questions. Your program allowed me the opportunity to expand on a lot of important issues and to discuss some valuable insights not available outside my book. Well, thanks for that, David. Anything to add to that, Ronnie?
Of course, we're only going to read comments from people that love us, right? You know that, but David Gibb was a great guest, and the Williams, you know, murder case was just unbelievably fascinating. You know, this high level military guy that used to transport you know, the Queen of England around, and he turns out to be one of the most notorious killers in Canadian history. It was just phenomenal, and he was so normal. That's what really shakes you up. And of course, I haven't looked at you the same way, Willie, after that show.
And likewise, I'm sure, Ronnie. Likewise, I'm sure, buddy. Anyway, wish all our listeners to go out there and buy the book. It's a great read. It's a wonderful, great read. Well, Ronnie, you want to give our listeners out there in a wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show? And tell us what you're up to in the publishing world.
Right. Well, we go from manhunts this week to the Italian Cosa Nostra Mafia and the Colombo War of 1989 to 1992, and we're going to have an actual hitman on the show. Larry Mazza was one of the hitmen on the Persico side of the war, and Tommy Dady is a detective on the case, and they happen to be friends going way back, so it's going to be very interesting, and we'll find out how he could talk about being a hitman on our show and still not be prosecuted on that. So that's going to be a real fascinating show, and we'll also have Bob Mladic on the show as well. He's going to be writing a book about the subject. So it should be a really interesting show. As for me, I suggest to our readers to go to the publishing company, strategicmediabooks.com. We got a couple of authors that we got a couple of really interesting books that are doing well. We got a book by Mickman Gordine, Chili Pimpin' in Atlantic City, and another book on Straight from the Hood, which with Scott Wilson and yours truly as co-authors on the book. And www.strategicmediabooks.com. Willie?
Great stuff, Ronnie. Wish you all the luck in the world, and I'm sure those books are going to be a great success. Well, Ronnie, as you know, the beat to crime never stops. It never, never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present a rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet features is a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. Here is this week's rap sheet item number one. Dateline, November 27th, 2011, Washington, D.C. Women in prison and American growth industry. Hey, Ronnie, did you know young women who have less than high school education and have a history of being battered and or sexually abused and have a history of drug abuse are being thrown into prison at alarming numbers? These women are most likely HIV positive and were infected with hepatitis C and have symptoms of mental illness and prior to their incarceration were unemployed. Hey, Ronnie, these women are being thrown into the slammer in record numbers. What's going on with this?
Well, this is quite amazing, and those are remarkable statistics, but here's some more. In 1980, before the war on drugs became big business and prison corporations got a toehold in America, there were something like 12,000 or so women incarcerated in the U.S. By 2008, that number had grown to over 200,000. And the rate of increase between 1995 and 2008 alone was a staggering 203%. Yep. And $9 million, that's what it cost in 1980 to incarcerate female offenders, and it's ballooned to over $68.7 billion. You talk about a growth industry, that's our prison industrial complex, which which a lot, myself and a lot of people refer to. And, you know, we've had a lot of attention on the military industrial complex. And I think that, you know, with given our these hard budget times, we should be taking a look at, you know, how we incarcerate prisoners and the cost involved. But unfortunately, nothing's being done in this area. But it's really an amazing phenomena and something that needs more investigation.
Absolutely. You know, just another statistic. Well, African-American women are the fastest-growing incarcerated population. Roughly 49% of the women in prison are white. 20% are African American, and almost 17% are Latina.
Right, and America's got the largest prison population for a country not at war, and it's something like over 4 million people incarcerated. Yep. And you imagine the cost, and half the drug offenses are marijuana offenses, you know, nonviolent offenses. And it's really ironic because the crime rate's supposed to be going down, yet the prison population is mushrooming.
Yeah,
figure that.
It's dreadful statistic, and hopefully we come to terms with that.
Right.
Well, let's get on to rap sheet item number two. Dateline, November the 19th, 2011. Southwest Ranches, Florida. Upscale Florida town in fight over plans for immigrant prison. In one of the South of Florida's upscale rural enclaves, where peacocks roam and horse trails are as common as sidewalks, town leaders decided to bring in much of their money from an unusual business, a prison. Hey, Ronnie, what's going on down there in the Garden of Eden?
Yeah, right. I mean, the city officials want to make money, and you know, town would have to pay something like $150,000 a year to keep this prison, a detention prison, and they're doing it because they feel it's a better place to keep nonviolent immigrant offenders. But the officials say the town would turn a profit of something like 4% of what U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement pays the company operating the prison to hold the inmates there. And the company is Corrections Corporation of America. It's the nation's largest prison operator. And this is kind of funny because, not funny, but it's kind of ironic because the city has had public notices, some like 24, but all of a sudden the city is having a lot of the residents are having second thoughts about having this detention center. And I think it's a little bit of a guilty conscience. You know, some of the comments of the citizens deal with, you know, yeah, we shouldn't be making money off of the misery of other people. So it's really interesting. It's an example of the prison industrial complex in action.
Well, no doubt it's a money maker. A lot of people incarcerated out there. Let's keep an eye on this story.
Right.
Now, just before we get on to a very special guest, Mr. Benjamin Runkle, author of Wanted Dead or Alive, Manhunt from Geronimo to Bin Laden, we'll take a brief station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First Worldwide Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Sepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have a question for our guest, email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to hear from you and try to incorporate your ideas into our future program. Well, Ronnie, tonight's very special guest is Mr. Ben Runkle, author of the best-selling book titled Wanted, Dead or Alive, Manhunt from Geronimo to Bin Laden. With the death of the most wanted person on the planet, Osama Bin Laden, came an end to a 10-year manhunt. Although the daring raid marked the end of the longest strategic manhunt in American history, Bin Laden was not the first individual targeted as the objective of a military campaign. From Geronimo to Pancho Villa, to Manuel Noriega, to Saddam Hussein, the United States has deployed military forces to kill or capture a single person nearly a dozen times since 1885. In his intriguing and fascinating book, Wanted Dead or Alive, Ben Runkle chronicles the extraordinary efforts of the military and intelligence agencies to bring American enemies to justice. It's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. take it away running.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Ben Runkle.
Thank you, Ron.
I have to admit, to say that your background is interesting as your book, and your book's really, really interesting. I enjoyed it. Maybe we should start off a little bit about your background and how it led to writing of the book about Wanted, Dead or Alive.
Okay.
And so you were one of the things that was interesting, you were a former paratrooper, but also a presidential speechwriter. So how do you get to be a former paratrooper and then go on to be a presidential speechwriter?
I was with the 82nd Airborne. I was an active duty officer, Army officer in the 1990s, and during which time I served with the 82nd Airborne. I like to say that I was in the what they would call the meaty part of the grading curve for officers. I was never going to be General Patton. I wasn't going to be Private Pyle at the same time, but realized I could have a better impact on U.S. national security as a scholar, at the time I thought an academic,
right,
or as a policymaker rather than as an officer. Now, remember, this was also the late 90s when we thought we would, quite frankly, we thought we were never going to go to war again. So went back to got a doctorate in international relations
from Harvard,
and ended up through a series of coincidences, ended up as a speechwriter for President Bush for about 4 months before, definition of irony, I was working on a speech on Iraq for National Security Advisor Steve Hadley when I got the word that I'd received a telegram calling me up back to active duty in Iraq.
Right, that was Operation Iraqi Freedom?
So this was in the fall of 2005, and so from March of 2006 to March of 2007, I served on active duty in Baghdad.
Right, but you served with distinction, because I believe you won a Bronze Star, right?
Yes, I did.
How did that happen?
I get very annoyed with friends of mine, people who were in the rear and said they were in combat. I received mortar fire. I never had the opportunity, thankfully, to fire back. And I think that's an important distinction to make, that I had a rear echelon job, and I was very good at it. You can't win a war without rear echelon people, but I also, there are tens of thousands of people who were under more risk than I, who weren't decorated in the same way, that deserve equal or higher accolades for their service.
Right.
So I want to just very clear on the distinction. I was very important for what I did in a rear planning strategic communications mode, but I also recognize I was not under threat in the same way that a lot of people who didn't get the same recognition were.
Right. Well, you obviously played an important role, and we recognize your service, you know, to the U.S., so that was really great on that. So is this where you got interested in manhunts? Because one of the biggest manhunts was for Saddam Hussein.
Actually, the idea predated that when I was finishing my dissertation, so I submitted my dissertation to my committee, and my dissertation was on arms races. It was very interesting to me, but it would make a lot of people's eyes sort of glaze over probably in these days. But I think I submitted it in February or March of 2003, I think right before Operation Iraqi Freedom started.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 2 months that, for anyone who's ever done a dissertation, there's about 2 or 3 months in between you submitting your dissertation, your thesis,
right,
and your committee ever
right
getting back to you to say, okay, it's okay to schedule a defense date. They don't
right
ask you to schedule a defense date unless you're ready. And in that time, for the first time in about 5 years, I had leisure to read whatever I wanted to instead of things that were specifically related to my research. And one of the books I read was Max Boot's Savage Wars of Peace. Excellent book. I commend to anyone. Boot noted that in his book, this was in the spring of 2003, noted the similarities between the hunt for Osama bin Laden and Pancho Villa, saying that noting the similarity of invading a country that was harboring a terrorist or bandit who had attacked the U.S. homeland with the specific objective of capturing or killing that individual.
Right.
He also, in talking about others, because he was talking about the larger problem of small wars, he noted the similarities between going after insurgent leaders such as Emilio Aguinaldo in the Philippines at the turn of the century,
mm-hmm,
or the U.S. Marines pursuing Nicaraguan insurgent leader Augusto Sandino from 1923 to 1933.
Right.
So I was drawn originally to it. These were just very fascinating adventure stories. And that's what really drew me to the topic. But in perhaps either the annals of procrastination or the annals of persistence, I didn't get around. It took me about 5 years until I'd been back from Iraq. I'd actually gotten out of government at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of thinking the topic continued to stay with me. Even after we'd captured Saddam, we'd killed Zarqawi, Bin Laden was still at large, the interest in the topic as just what a bunch of interesting stories, almost Tom Clancy-esque stories come to life.
Mm-hmm.
I never was able to shake the idea that I really want to learn more about these stories, and the only way to do it, quite frankly, was to write a book about the topic.
Right. Well, the book came out in August, right?
Yes.
And Bin Laden was killed in May 2nd,
yes.
I believe, right? So I would imagine that you had to stop the presses, right? And do some revision.
Very much so. I think I handed the final manuscript into the publisher, Palgrave Macmillan, in November, and I think I made the joke to either my editor or my agent or my wife, and I think I said that the only thing that can go wrong now is if they actually find him, and laughing because it just seemed such a far-off probability.
Right.
And then remembering that night on May 1st, I had a little advance notice of that it was that when the president announced he was going to do a press conference on Sunday night, May 1st, I had been given a little advance notice that it was going to be the announcement of Bin Laden. And so there was a little suddenly like, wait a second. The first thought was, of course, hooray, thank you, that someone who was very bad has met justice. And then there was a little bit, I'd be lying if I didn't admit that there was about 10% concern of, uh-oh, what does this mean for the book? And then the next morning, I had two or three messages on my answering machine at my office from the head of the publishing company saying, hey, this is great, we're going to move publication up, but oh, by the way, can you revise 4 chapters? So there had to be, at a minimum, there had to be a revision of just the simple tense of, if we ever get him, to change it to, now that we've gotten him. And it really did have to do some thinking about how did the lessons learned that I drew from the other 10 cases, the other 125 years of strategic manhunts, did the Abbottabad raid support those, or did those? Was it an outlier?
Right. So you're looking for some kind of, resolution from studying these 8 cases, right? And what could be used for military engagement in the future?
That was the original intent when it was an ongoing manhunt for Bin Laden. The intent was, having learned these lessons from these other cases, how do we apply this? What does this inform us for Bin Laden? And then suddenly it became, did the Bin Laden case conform to it? But I also very much made the argument, and this was my intent all along from, the moment I conceived in 2008, is just very much the realization that this is much more going to be a more prominent tool of American strategic policy. Going forward for a variety of structural reasons.
Right.
And I think that's already proven true with the fact that we're already now engaged in the hunt for the leader of the Lord's Resistance Army, Joseph Kony, that this is just something that we're going to do more often in the future. So I think the lessons learned, one, it's useful to reanalyze and rethink what we thought we knew about the Bin Laden manhunt, but also going forward, I wanted very much, yes, to apply lessons learned that U.S. military commanders and policymakers would be able to use in the future.
I would imagine policymakers and military leaders are decision makers are reading your book because I think it would provide a lot of useful information for them moving forward. But one of the things, Ben, that you make a point of, it, you don't talk about manhunts, you talk about strategic manhunts. Right? Can you explain what you mean by strategic manhunts, and how would it differ from manhunt?
I define strategic manhunts as anytime the United States deploys forces abroad, military forces abroad, to kill or capture one individual. And I distinguish it from a variety of other types of missions. I distinguish it from decapitation strikes, where you're trying to take out an organization and you try and kill individuals, but largely because of their role in a larger organization. It's part of a broader strategy against that organization. I distinguish it from, obviously, from assassinations. I distinguish it from coups, where you are targeting an individual, but you're distinctly not using U.S. forces, from targets of opportunity, like the raid that killed Admiral Yamamoto in 1943, where it wasn't a goal of the war to kill Yamamoto, but if you have a chance to kill the enemy's best leader, then you're going to do so. And also distinguishing it from retaliatory attacks, such as Operation El Dorado Canyon, which was the strike against Gaddafi in Libya in 1986. But even though they didn't get him, they didn't continue operations. or say the Desert Fox strikes in 1998 against Saddam Hussein,
right,
which were meant to essentially deter him from non-cooperation with the weapons inspectors.
Right.
I also would distinguish it, at least analytically, from domestic manhunts, in that, again, the difference being military force and abroad versus internally against domestic criminals.
Right. Like the FBI.
Yes.
Right.
That this has national security implications rather than domestic criminal or domestic law implications.
Right. Well, we're going to talk about some of them. There's eight of them. We're going to start with Geronimo, but we're going to take a station break first, and then we'll come back with our fascinating interview with Ben Runkle.
You bet, Ronnie. And after the station break, I've got a quick question for Ben.
Okay.
You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepstick and Will Brib. Now back with Ron and Mr. Benjamin Runkle, author of the best-selling book titled Wanted, Dead or Alive, Manhunt from Geronimo to Bin Laden. Ben, I've got a question.
Before we go on, Willie, we'll just ask Ben a little bit about the book and where the best some tips on buying the book. I'm sure it's available on Amazon, right?
Yes.
Right, and are you on Facebook? Do you have a website?
I have a website. It's funny because there was once upon a time a TV show called Wanted, Dead or Alive.
And I remember that.
And the Bon Jovi song. So the website is www.wdoabook, so wdoabook.blogspot.com.
Good. I was trying to look you up, and I couldn't find it today on the internet on that then. But that would be where they could get more information. And the book's published, of course, by Palgrave Macmillan. And you're also a contributing writer to the Weekly Standard, which is a respected newspaper. Magazine, and you can go to the website weeklystandard.com to see, read some of Ben's articles. I know you did a lot of spin-offs, right, from the book.
I was very much it was funny going from 0 to 60 that week suddenly a high demand for op-eds that I was published in Weekly Standard, Foreign Policy, Washington Post, subsequently when Gaddafi was overthrown but still on the loose, The Guardian in Great Britain asked for a submission on Gaddafi. Foreign Policy called again, so no, there's been a lot of interest in it since the Bin Laden killing. But as I say, I think it's an ongoing issue.
Right, Willie, you had a question?
Yeah, I sure did. Ben, as you mentioned earlier, it's a prominent tool for U.S. foreign policy to use this tactic. The question. Remains the legality in international law. Are we setting an example that other countries can target us with people that they perceive are doing harm to them? Any comments on that?
I'm always hesitant to say anything when international law comes up, just given that I'm not a lawyer and it's very specific to it. I think that was definitely a concern with regards to some of the with the ongoing drone campaign in Pakistan. The question of, is it legal to, if another state is not able to go after someone who's a threat to your national security, can you therefore self-identify and say, they're not able to do it, we therefore abrogate the right? And I think there are legitimate concerns about that, that right now we're the only ones with the capability to do it. And so there are some legitimate concerns about that. But I would also say that I think there is for the 99.99%, even throw in another 9 in there, percent, there's little doubt that the people who we have targeted have posed a threat, do mean hostile intent to U.S. citizens and U.S. interests abroad.
Right.
So,
and given the tendency for many countries to jump on the United States when it comes to international law, it's telling that there wasn't much controversy surrounding Noriega or Saddam Hussein or Bin Laden, right?
No, there's
some
been
of the major ones.
There's been very little to date so far, which I agree. It's a strange thing that you would think that normally that anything we do is the United States does is a lightning rod for dissent and protest around the world. But it might be saying of that who specifically we have targeted have been such heinously, for lack of a better term, villains or bad guys, that there's been little dispute. No one shed a tear in any part of the world, I think, when Gaddafi was killed. Not that we specifically targeted him.
Right.
But similarly, Saddam Hussein really didn't have a lot of supporters around the world. I don't think anyone disputed that,
right.
Even though they might have supported Osama bin Laden versus us. I don't think very many people disputed the right that we
right.
disputed that we had the right to target him. So,
right. Now you select 8 and you start with Geronimo. Was that the first major manhunt in U.S. history? Military manhunt in U.S. history?
By my definition, yes. By applying the abroad standard to it, and I originally wasn't going to do a Geronimo case for two reasons. That one, I wasn't aware, I just didn't have enough knowledge of the case,
right.
that U.S. troops actually went as far as 230 miles into Mexico in pursuit of Geronimo.
Wow.
I had thought it was entirely within territories or U.S. sovereign territory.
Right.
The other one was, quite frankly, that the deathly fear of putting anything with the title of Geronimo and bin Laden in a title together and the firestorm that
right.
might create, but the Navy SEALs basically cleared the underbrush on that for me. So.
Right. Well, you know, Geronimo is a real legend. I mean, remember we were kids, and Willie may remember this. We used to run around the neighborhood when we were like 8 or 9 yelling, Geronimo, because we
right.
used to see the movies, you know, back in the 60s and all that. But would he be considered I was reading your book, I was wondering, would he be considered a terrorist today? Because, you know, after each victory, he ordered mass executions. He was ruthless, you know, in killing settlers, and not only adults, but children.
I'm hesitant on that just because I want to tread very carefully, because the Chiricahua Apache, the Apaches at writ large were badly treated by the United States government. They were actually treated with a good deal of respect by the U.S. Army. The soldiers and officers who lived with them actually had working understandings and a great deal of respect. It was actually the civilian government that treated them very badly, that gave them land that was fairly worthless, treated them on the rations.
Right.
And there were some really incredible leaders and, for lack of a better term, warriors amongst the... It was a warrior culture, really, especially the Chiricahua Warm Spring Apaches, that produced, I mean, just incredible leaders like Cochise, Mangus Colorado,
right.
who really should be American icons. Geronimo was much more controversial, that the immediate causes, even though the Apache were in a bad situation, the immediate causes of his outbreak really came over to their rights to brew an alcoholic beverage that they brewed, but they had a ritual that they often, quite frankly, became very violent after
mm-hmm.
this. They'd starve themselves for a couple of days and then drink in order to get medicinal hallucinations, but they also were also prone to violence afterwards. And they also were, I mean, and this is... Hard to say without sounding culturally insensitive.
Right.
They were abusive of their spouses,
mm-hmm.
and so they were adamant about the warriors were adamant about their right to be able to abuse wives that were suspected of infidelity. And these were the two actual triggers to the outbreak.
Right.
And this is not to say the U.S. government did not do right by them in the first place.
Right.
But these were the short-term causes of it. And Geronimo lied to the other warriors to get them to leave the reservation. He told them that he had already arranged the assassination of the head of the reservation, Lieutenant Britton Davis, which was not true. And when the other Apaches, Mangus, who was one of Mangus Colorado's sons, Naiche, Chihuahua, when they learned of this, they were very angry and nearly turned on Geronimo, but realized they were sort of in the same ship together on the run, that they couldn't afford the dissension. So Geronimo was controversial even within Apache circles up until sort of, I don't want to say revisionist history, but
right.
Geronimo was also very savvy public relations-wise after he got captured.
Right.
But I would not put him in the same class as Osama bin Laden as
right.
far as the height of his violence or et cetera.
Right. Especially given the history of the way the majority population have treated Native Americans, I think that you can say that. But you know, as your book points out, he was never captured and he wasn't killed because of the manhunt, but he never became a serious threat to American border states. So. To diminish that. So how would you describe the manhunt? Was it a success? This is the first manhunt in history. Was it a success? And what did they learn from that manhunt?
Well, it ultimately was a success. He started, when he broke out from the San Carlos Reservation in May of 1885, he had about 170 warriors and followers on, so roughly halfly divided between the warriors and then spouses and children. By the time he surrendered in September of 1886, he only had about 17 to 20 left. that the other Apaches had decided that life on the run, it wasn't worth it. They couldn't. They ultimately, being pursued both by the United States Cavalry and the Mexicans, that they've just their chance, their prospects weren't very good, and they were willing to take their chances with another peace deal with the U.S. Government. And some of this was due to, though, the constant pursuit of the United States Cavalry made it difficult for them, that even though they weren't able to capture the Apaches were always able to stay one step ahead. They were quite often able to capture their supplies, which made life on the run difficult, which made, especially in the wintertime, made it difficult for them.
Right. Excuse me, go ahead.
Well, the lessons that could be learned from it that were applicable to other future manhunts were, one, the importance of indigenous forces, that mm-hmm. the Apache scouts who worked with the U.S. Cavalry, who knew the terrain, who knew the renegade Apache's habits, mm-hmm. were invaluable to being able to keep up or even to stay one step behind Geronimo. Local intelligence that ultimately in August of 1886, Mexican farmers who were tired of Geronimo's depredations, I mean, they raided and killed many Mexicans mm-hmm. who were tired of him, told U.S. troops where he was.
Right.
And that made a big difference. The lack of a sanctuary, that the difference between Geronimo and Pancho Villa in being able to capture or being able to induce Geronimo to surrender and the failure to capture or kill Pancho Villa, despite having twice as many troops in 1914 and despite having higher levels of 1916,
right.
And having higher levels of technology, planes, radios, trucks, was that the local population hated Geronimo and was willing to help American forces find him, versus Pancho Villa being seen as a folk hero, and therefore the local population willing to help hide Villa, as well as the Mexican government not willing to give him sanctuary.
Right.
So those three lessons of indigenous forces, local human intelligence, and the availability of sanctuary are a prevailing theme across the roughly dozen manhunts I look
right.
at in the book.
Did you think military leaders learn? I mean, do they study like Geronimo in military academies? And have you seen evidence that the military has learned from these manhunts, which went on, 100 years ago, 120 years ago?
Not likely. And I think something's lost. That I think that writ large, the Indian Wars, there are a lot of similarities between the strategic problem that those wars posed and what we call nowadays modern counterinsurgency.
Right.
And in fact, the leader of the original leader of the Apache campaign, General George Crook, was an innovator in doctrine in a lot of ways, not dissimilar to General David Petraeus.
Right.
He was famous for his being able to physically keep up with his troops, whereas Petraeus did his push-up contests and was an avid runner. Crook was known as an outdoorsman. He believed very much in treating the Apaches very well when he was in charge of the Arizona Territory. He said it was easier to prevent an outbreak than to chase them down when they went out. And he was also one of the most ardent advocates of using Apaches as scouts, mm-hmm. which his successor, General Nelson A. Miles, who went on to be a very famous general as well, didn't believe that the Apaches were reliable and that you should be developing indigenous forces. But most of the principles that Crook advocated back in 1885, 1886 are very similar to modern counterinsurgency doctrine.
Right. In your book, you go from Geronimo and you jump up to Manuel Noriega, to 1989. This was a sort of a problematic manhunt, right, the way it started off, because of Noriega's unique relationship with the U.S. government, being a CIA asset at one time, and being in good graces of the United States.
Well,
and I know that you point out that Reagan tried to use the carrot and the stick, rather than force it first.
Well, by the time that we actually went after Noriega, though, in December of 1989, mm-hmm. and this dates back to the actual indictments against him in U.S. courts for his money laundering related to, and drug trafficking.
Right.
Even his relationship with the intelligence agencies couldn't save him at that point. From February 1988 on, it was U.S. government policy that he had to go one way or another.
Right. But there was a lot of debate within U.S. government circles, right?
But by that point, once he was under indictment, no U.S. administration, whether it was the Reagan administration in the last
right.
year of 88 or the first year of the Bush administration of George H.W. Bush in 1989, you really couldn't be seen as being soft in those days on someone who was who was under indictment for the things that he was under indictment for.
Right. Well, Campaign Operation Just Cause, you know, it's only like 20 years, and I guess the thing I remember most was the being a lover of rock music with heavy metal music, loudspeakers, I think anybody would remember that. Did it have any effect on the Noriega who was holed up at the time?
Absolutely none. That occurred on December 23rd, he arrived at the Papal Nunciatura. The one embassy, the U.S. was very smart that it cut off his means of escape. It cut off the places where he could potentially have sanctuary,
right,
including the Cuban embassy, the Nicaraguan embassy, I think ironically now the Libyan embassy,
right,
places where they thought he might try and escape.
Right.
The last place they thought Noriega would ever try to escape to would be the Vatican's embassy, given his hostility to the Catholic Church within Panama.
Right.
And sure enough, on December 23rd, that's where he escapes to, where many victims of his oppression had gone to for asylum. That's where he ends up in asylum.
Right.
So outside of the embassy, General Thurman, the U.S. generals, if they wanted to have a meeting outside the front gate of the Nunciatura, they realized that the hotel where all the media were staying was only about 100 yards away, and they all had very large boom microphones.
Right.
And so they decided, in order to try and prevent them from overhearing their deliberations between one another and potential deliberations or negotiations with the Vatican staff, that they told the PSYOPs people to set up some music to create a wall of sound. And General Jerry Boykin writes one of the best detailed accounts of this in his very obscure memoir of this, saying that being young guys, they played it very rock and roll, and they played it very loud. And so it lasted for about 2 days, from the 27th to the 29th. Noriega claimed he was in the back of the embassy and couldn't hear it. He was known as an opera lover, and it was thought that the loud rock and roll would drive him to distraction, when in fact it drove Monsignor Laboa, who was the head of the nunciature, it was driving all the Vatican staff crazy. And finally they asked the State Department to stop it, and sure enough, Secretary of State Baker called then-General Colin Powell into his office and said, it has to stop, and it did. And it had, as far as anybody knows, absolutely zero effect. That Noriega didn't surrender for a week, almost a week after the music stopped. So.
Right. On that, let's take a break, and we'll go into the last part of the interview with Ben Runkle, and it's a really fascinating subject, and we'll try to cover a little bit about Bin Laden in the last part, and have our audience read the book, because we're going to leave out a lot because of the wide expanse of the topic. Willie?
Yeah, you bet, Ronnie. We could go for 3 hours on this one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Crime Beat on the Artist's First World Radio Network with Ron Stefanik and Will Ripp. Now back with Ron and Mr. Ben Runkle, author of the best-selling book titled Wanted Dead or Alive, Manhunt from Geronimo to Bin Laden.
Right. We're back with Ben Runkle, the author, and once again, Ben, your website for our listeners who may have missed it.
www.wdoabook, so wdoabook.blogspot, blogspot. .com.
Right. Well, as you point out in your book, that you believe that the Noriega manhunt was a success because it allowed Panama to make a successful transition to democracy, but they haven't all been successes, right? And we're talking about the disaster in Somalia. And maybe you can talk about that and then talk about how the U.S. rebounded with Iraq, which I think whatever you feel about the Iraq war, it was probably a success.
Well, there are two things. That one, it is a surprise that I went into this thinking very much that, of course, it matters whether or not you get the targeted individual. That's just simple logic. But when you take the 11 cases in the book and you look at basically whether operational success matches strategic success or operational failure coincides with strategic failure, you find only four out of the 10 cases, and I exclude Bin Laden just because it's too early to tell whether Bin Laden, the killing of Bin Laden leads to the ultimate defeat of Al-Qaeda. It's too soon to tell. But only in 4 of the 10 cases does operational success correlate with strategic success.
Right.
The ones where it does correlate are Geronimo, the killing of Che Guevara in Bolivia in 1967 ended the hemispheric threat of communist insurgency.
Right.
And the, obviously then the capture of Noriega led to Panama's transformation. But there are a lot of cases where we did capture or kill the individual, but it didn't lead to strategic success. That includes the capture of Filipino insurgent leader Emilio Aguinaldo, killing of Pablo Escobar, capture of Saddam Hussein, and killing of Zarqawi.
Right.
And there are other cases also, ironically, where we've failed operationally but succeeded strategically, including Pancho Villa and Augusto Sandino.
Right.
And go ahead.
I was going to say, in your book, you divide the manhunt for bin Laden into two parts. You have the first part, which deals with Bora Bora and the failure to get him at that time. And then you deal with the successful one, you know, with the Navy SEALs and May going into Pakistan and all that. Can you talk about the connection between the two parts and what they learned? Or were they learning anything from Bora Bora? Because, you know, it was such a negative press about the failure of the U.S. Forces to get bin Laden.
Well, I think there are two ways to answer that. The first one is that there's a huge disconnect, that really if you talk to the intelligence people, the people in the intelligence community, the trail really did genuinely go cold for almost 9 years from his disappearance in December 2001 after he escaped from Tora Bora until the trail sort of reactivated in the fall of 2010. Now, there were things going on in between, basically when they captured a lot of people and interrogated them at Guantanamo or other sites, and the name of one courier kept coming up. But it wasn't clear at the time that this courier is what will lead to bin Laden. And it took a long time for them to get the courier's real name, to figure out where he was operating, then to figure out where he actually lived. And that was when they sort of, by doing some very good inductive logic, saying, okay, he lives in a house that looks like it was designed to hide someone.
Right.
Who could that be? It was brilliant analytical work, but they did not follow him because they knew that he would lead to bin Laden. So the connection between from December 2001 to, say, September 2010 is very thin.
Right.
That the trail really went cold in a way that you haven't seen in other strategic manhunts.
Well, what's really interesting, you know, with all the high tech and everything, a lot of people find it, you know, hard to believe that a trail. And when you watch Hollywood movies, you know, dealing with espionage and all that, that a trail could go cold in today's world, interconnected world. How do you explain that? I mean, what was the problem? Was the fact lack of cooperation from Pakistan? Where he was hiding, you know, in the hills. How do you explain that?
Well, we overestimate the ability of technology to find individuals. I found over the course of my dozen cases is that technology is rarely the decisive variable in determining the operational success or failure of strategic manhunts. This applies not only to the lethality of the weapon systems involved. Remember, at Tora Bora, we deployed over 1,000 precision-guided munitions, a 15,000-pound daisy cutter bomb. I mean, we basically threw everything we had in the arsenal at him, but didn't get him.
Right.
But it applies to intelligence platforms as well. Although the level of technology involved in manhunting campaigns has increased from Geronimo through bin Laden, both absolutely and relative to the capabilities of our adversaries, targeted individuals are usually able to develop countermeasures.
Mm-hmm.
Pablo Escobar famously warned his son to stay off the phone. And then he made one mistake.
Right.
And it wasn't him being on the phone that did it. It was he was seen through the window. They went to the wrong location.
Right.
We're coming up on the 20th, almost, it's going to actually the 19th.
That's right, December 2nd.
Yes.
Right?
So I'll blog about, I have to remember to blog about that tomorrow.
Right.
Thank you.
Right.
It got him in the neighborhood, but it went to the wrong location. And then as they were driving, thinking the mission was a failure, the son of the commander of the Colombian police unit saw him through the window. So it was local human intelligence that mattered more than the technology.
Right.
Saddam Hussein claimed, when he was interrogated by the FBI after his capture, he claimed to have only used the phone twice since Desert Storm in 1991,
right.
And bin Laden stopped using his phones in 1998. Similarly, you know, there's a limit to what satellite imagery does. We never caught Saddam on a satellite. We never caught Zarqawi on a satellite. The NGIA, National Geographic Geospatial Intelligence Agency, only saw bin Laden once. They saw a figure walking around, and they couldn't see his face. And so they did very innovative. They said, well, let's measure his shadow. If we see his shadow and know what time of day it is, we can do a rough estimate of how tall he was. And they came back to the president and said, we have 95% certainty that this man is between 5'8" and 6'8". Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you know, I mean, that eliminates, I'm shorter than 5'8", so that eliminates me. But for 80% of the male population, there are limits to what technology can do.
Right.
Yeah, Ronnie, I've got a quick
Before we're winding it up, Willie, we got about 5 minutes here, so we're going to wind up with one last question here. On what about the future of manhunts?
I think the future is going to look a lot like the past.
We've got about 45 seconds.
Okay, I will try and wrap this up as quickly as possible then. I think Tora Bora, the troop strength, is a canard. It's a conventional wisdom, but it's wrong, that what really matters is the human terrain, is the attitudes of the local population. Do they provide you with intelligence? Do they provide you with forces? Is there a sympathetic sanctuary for them? And I think that will continue to matter for manhunts for the foreseeable future. I do not think Pete Blaber has written about this, former Delta Force commander has written about this in the past. There's just not a technological cure-all.
Right.
And that troop strength, you can never have so many troops that you can guarantee. It's what will people hide them? What is the local population's attitudes?
Right. We really appreciate having you on the show, Ben. One thing, I think it was December 7th, I think it was 92 or 93. I don't think it was this year.
It was 93, I think.
Yeah, I think it was 93, right, on that. So what we really appreciate, and I advise our readers to get the book. We just touched the surface of the topic. It's really fascinating. And we hope to have you on again. Keep us informed what you're doing, Ben.
No, thank you very much for having me, Ron.
Okay, you're welcome, Ben. Thank you.
Yeah,
take
thanks,
care.
Thank
you, Willie.
Thanks a lot. Well, Ronnie, what a great interview. Like I said, we could have went 3-4 hours.
Yeah, and I'm sorry to cut you off. We're cutting up to the...
I'm going to email my question to Ben a little bit later in the evening.
Right. Well, why don't you email him, and we'll read it next week and
bet,
on the thing there.
Well, Ronnie, what did you learn about a program about this fascinating subject?
Right. Well, I mean, it's an open-ended whether manhunts work or not. I mean, you look at some of them, they were failures. Some of them they were questionable, and some of them were outright successes. But I'm hoping that our military leaders are learning from Ben's book and a little bit about the past, so that we could help deal with our enemies in the future. How about you, Willie?
Well, I learned that U.S. authorities will stop at nothing to get their prey. I guess it's a way of surgically taking out an individual who wants to harm the U.S. citizens and the government. But it does smack of vigilante justice, and quite frankly, I believe it's used in a sinister way to hide the truth at times from the general public. I want to believe that capturing an alleged criminal and putting him on trial so the whole world can judge for themselves is the way to go. This is like the Wild West. Shoot first, ask questions later.
Well, I mean, you're a bleeding heart Canadian.
Well, I'll tell you. Anyway, now, Ronnie, at this time, we're going to bring you our Crime Beat Gangster Nickname Segment of the Month. Hey, Ronnie, get a load of this one. Jack Diamond was a famous Irish-American gangster in New York City during the Prohibition era who had more than one nickname. One of his monikers was Legs Diamond, a.k.a. Gentleman Jack. A bootlegger and a close associate of gambler Arnold Rothstein. Diamond survived a number of attempts on his life between 1919 and 1931, causing him to be known as the Clay Pigeon of the underworld. In 1930, Diamond's nemesis, Dutch Schultz, remarked to his gang, "Ain't there anybody that can shoot this guy so he don't bounce back?" Anyway,
his
comments on it.
Yeah, they called him Legs, and I thought they called him Legs because he had great legs like you, Willie.
Yeah,
but I found out that when I did a little research that they really don't know why he was called Legs. But he had one interesting association, Arnold Rothstein. If you're a baseball fan, you know the Black Sox scandal in 1919, and Rothstein was with the guy behind it on that.
Well, baseball hasn't been the same since, buddy.
That's right.
Now, just a reminder for all our listeners out there: our next program is a triple whammy, and the schedule for December the 8th. We'll have as a special guest Mr. Larry Mazza, former hitman, and Tommy Daines, a former police detective, and Bob Mladenich, a writer who is writing a book on this very fascinating subject of the Colombo Mafia War of the early 1990s, a deadly war, by the way. It's going to be a great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar or put it in your BlackBerry and make sure you don't want to miss that one. Well, we hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First Worldwide Radio Network with Ron Chepstick and yours truly, Will Harib. For all of you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First Worldwide Radio Network. We'd like to thank all of you out there for listening to our broadcast this evening. And in the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. And please spread the word about our program. If you want to support our broadcast, please make a contribution to Crime Beat by the Artist First World Radio Network. The address is on the top page of the website for your quick reference. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Chepstick and myself, Will Harib, I hope you tune in to Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.